Good morning to each of you. Greetings in Jesus' name. Nice to see the house well filled. I would like for us this morning to think about the subject of submission to the call of God. In Archbold, Ohio, is a place called Souder Village where they have old-fashioned craftsmen working. And there's a man by the name of Mark Nofziger there who does pottery. And he made this little lamp here, just a little oil lamp with a wick in it. And he enjoys talking about his work, and I've enjoyed watching him go about his work, describing the process. There are many commercial methods of making pottery, but to me, none hold the fascination of a potter working on his wheel. The process is obviously a little messy, involves water and clay and spinning wheels. Mark wears an apron, which is often fairly dirty. He makes it look easy, but then he's been doing it for well over 35 years. And this little lamp can't tell you its story, so I would like to tell you its story for it. This was made out of clay, or more specifically, something called clay body, and it would arrive at the potter's shop in as a bag of powder. And this is a careful formulation of natural clay and other minerals. And as he stirs this with water, he applies a precise ratio of water to that clay body to get the proper material to mix it up. And it's a light gray, it's just mud, shapeless glob. But then if you watch Mark put this thing on the wheel, he takes his hands and first of all he moves it so it's perfectly centered on the wheel, and then he works a little bit and then he takes his thumbs and he starts making an indention in the middle. And as that thing spins, it's very fascinating to watch this thing take shape under his hands. That indention becomes the inside of a little lamp like that. And then, of course, he keeps building it and brings it back together and expands it at the top. And he keeps working at it. But a wheel is not the only tool that he uses. And he makes many other things besides little lamps. He may use calipers to measure both the inside and outside dimensions to get everything, especially if he makes a lot of these, which he does. He likes to have them consistent in their size and their shape. He uses sponges to absorb water and to distribute it. He uses strips of leather to compress and to smooth this thing as he's working with it. And then he may use heavy needles, he may use wire, he may use something called fettling knife to cut and trim, especially like thinking about the top edges of this thing here. And he may also use wooden modeling tools for some things, such as pitchers. He'll have to put a handle on it and he'll shape a spout. So you can't do everything on the wheel, but he's got things to work with it after it comes off the wheel. And he also used brushes, and we'll talk about that a little bit further. But once this pot was done, it didn't have all this color on it. It's still just gray mud, so to speak. He would set it on a shelf to dry for a while, for a number of days, and it would lose about 5% of its size while that happened. But sitting on that shelf, he could take it, he could drop it into a basin of water, and it would go right back to the clay that he originally molded. But things happened to this thing when it got put in the fire. He's got a kiln there. He carefully manages the temperature of that. And when this thing reached 900 degrees, it could no longer melt back into the clay that it was. A chemical change took place, and it wouldn't dissolve, but it was very fragile. If he would have taken it out of the fire and worked it or tried to do something with it, it would probably crumble in his hands. And we talk about something being half-baked. Well, that's the condition that little lamp was in when it hit 900 degrees. But Mark wasn't done. He kept heating up that kiln hotter and hotter, until it reached 1800 to 2100 degrees Fahrenheit. And then some of the minerals in that clay body would actually start melting. And that is what locks it, what gives it its strength and rigidity, and makes it to where it can actually be useful. It formed a glue there. And when that initial heating was done, this was not earthenware. It was not stoneware. It was called biscuitware. And it would be fairly strong, but it would be still be very porous, and it would not work very well for holding oil or water or other liquids. But Mark wasn't done. He would take this little thing, and if you look, you see these little feather-like shapes that he drew on there. And those were not blue when he put them on. He would take a glaze, he would glaze it, and this glaze had different chemicals and minerals in it, and he would coat the inside and the outside, and then it would go back into the kiln again. And if he heated it up to 2100 degrees, it would be called earthenware, no longer biscuitware, and it would still contain a tiny percentage of water. But if he kept heating it, which I believe is what he did with this thing, and took it over 2200 degrees, then it is stoneware. It is much stronger, it is harder, it is resistant to breakage, and it can be used in fairly rough circumstances without being damaged. Incidentally, if you have a piece of handmade pottery and you're curious as to whether it's earthenware or stoneware, put it in the microwave for about a minute. If there's any moisture left inside, that thing will warm up by itself. If there's no moisture left, you can microwave it and get it out, and it's almost as cool as when you put it in. And that would tell you that there's no moisture in there and that it's stoneware. God spoke about pottery. Turn your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 18. God had a very vivid lesson for Jeremiah using pottery, and we would like to look this morning in thinking of submission to the call of God and the lessons we learn from pottery through the scripture and through the natural work of making pottery. Jeremiah 18, I would like to read the first six verses. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause thee to hear my words. Then I went down to the potter's house, and behold, he wrought a work on the wheels. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter, so he made it again another vessel, as it seemed good to the potter to make it. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter, saith the Lord? Behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are ye in mine hand, O house of Israel. God had a lesson for Israel through the work of Jeremiah back then. God has a lesson for us this morning as well. And the first thing that we notice is that this was God's initiative. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, you go down to the potter's house. Now, God could have spoken to Jeremiah right where he was, but he said, you go down there, and I'm going to be showing you something. And when we think of whether it's an ordination or other work of the church, God is the potter. God is the doer. He is the great initiator, and this is God's work and not ours. Too often we think that if we do everything just right, that the outcome is going to be guaranteed. We feel like we're responsible for the outcome, and that feeling of responsibility is good as long as we recognize that the final outcome is not in our hands. It's in God's hands. God partners with us. He gives us responsibility, but the outcome is in his hand. It is his work. And if we look at clay, in the context that Jeremiah was listening and understanding, it was the house of Israel, and that's specifically mentioned in verse 6. But when we look at clay this morning, that this little thing here might represent me, it might represent you, or it might represent an entire congregation, because God works with us both individually and collectively. What lessons can we learn from this thing? Well, there's at least half a dozen that I would like for us to think about in relation to this. Again, this thing cannot tell its story, but there's a lot we can learn when we understand its story. First of all, clay takes careful formulation and preparation. They will mine this clay in various locations throughout the world and come up with the absolute correct or the best ideal formulation to make something like this. They don't just take mud. And we find God doing that as he works with us individually and also as congregations. God told Jeremiah when he called him, he said, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. When I was before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee." And then Friday evening, Brother Murray read from the first part of Psalm 139. If we'd read a little bit further there, we have David's testimony about God's care and planning for him before he was born. He said this, "My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them." And not only individually, but God takes special care in formulating the church, including the circumstances that make each congregation unique. Turn to Ephesians chapter 2, and we see a little bit of this in a slightly different illustration, but which applies equally well, I believe. Ephesians chapter 2. Notice the care that goes into the building of the church. We'll start with verse 19 and go down to verse 22. It says, "Now therefore ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone." And then notice verse 21, "in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit." Here we have the comparison being with a building, but notice that fitly framed together, the care that God exercises in putting his church together. So, this clay was a special formulation. But, lest we get an inflated idea of our natural value, think about how ugly that clay was before the potter actually started working with it. Clay isn't beautiful until it's shaped and fired and glazed. For all practical purposes, it's just a lump of gray mud and dirt. It's valuable to grow crops in, but this clay wouldn't grow anything. I had to think, you know, mud is really isn't much use except to small boys and maybe politicians. It's not something that is of value to us until something is done with it. And man is even worse until God works on him. You can turn to Romans chapter 3. But before we read out of that, I'd like to read a couple passages in the Old Testament that specify how terrible we are until God gets his hands on him. Again, Jeremiah 17, verse 9, the chapter right before the one we read. "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" And then Isaiah chapter 1, he speaks this way, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they have forsaken the Lord." And then he goes on a couple verses later, he says, "The whole head is sick and the whole heart faint, from the sole of the foot even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores." That means extremely smelly sores. "They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment." You envision someone who is sick, has open sores in their body, they're filthy. There's just nothing attractive about a person like that. And so, lest we think that that was just in the Old Testament, notice the passage in the book of Romans, chapter 3. Starting with verse 9. It says, "What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have before proved both Jews and Gentiles that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God. They are all going out of the way, they are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And then over to verse 33, a very common verse, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Clay may be specially formulated, but is ugly and worthless until God puts his hands on it. And that is the way it is with us. Now, as I mentioned, when this little lamp was made, there was a process involved. There was the turning, there was the shaping, the using of different tools. There was the initial firing, making it into biscuitware, and then there was the glazing, and then there was the second firing. It was a process, and even for a skilled potter like Mark, that takes time. And we find that happening as well as God works with us. And maybe another illustration of that is our children. I remember when our first child was born, you think of interacting with them and having fun with them and conversations, and my head told me, that wasn't going to happen right away. But you think of how little communicating you can do with a baby. They can express basic needs, they can show love in their eyes and their smiles and so on, but to have a heart-to-heart connection, it doesn't happen. Or maybe I should say a brain-to-brain connection, it doesn't happen. It takes a lot of time. And as you raise children, maybe sometimes you despair that they will ever mature. But it takes time. And that's the exact same thing that God does with us as he works with us. God never made man instantly. Even in the initial making of man, there was two steps involved in forming him out of the dust of the ground and then breathing into his nostrils the breath of life. And so a process that takes a while with a lamp takes a while with us as well. Now we get to the fourth comparison. Thinking again about this potter, he had a whole row of these vessels shaped very similarly. He made them as it seemed good to him. He had a plan in his mind when he started with that lump. He had the exact right size that he needed for the plan that he had in mind, and he made it as it seemed good to him. And when God works in our lives, when he shapes us, he has a specific plan in mind. It's not like he doodles around and says, oh, you know what, this might be interesting, so he makes us this way. Before he ever throws us on the wheel, he knows what he is after. And that's a difference between us and God. Our understanding of God's plans is minuscule compared to what his purposes are. And I think this is the point where we may end up struggling the most in submitting to him. And here is where the comparison of this little lamp with us breaks down. No natural comparison is perfect or can go all the way through. Because unlike clay, we can accept or resist the tools, whether it's the wheel or some of the other ones I mentioned, that God uses to shape us. We can resent the things that are pushing on us and giving us pressure or heat, and we can become bitter and cynical as a result of our reaction to those things. Or we can submit to their shaping and their purifying work, and we can allow God to make into what he wants through those tools. And furthermore, this little thing had absolutely no choices to make. The potter worked on it, and it did what he wanted it to. We are allowed to make our own decisions. In fact, God expects us to make our own decisions. He's there to give us wisdom. He uses other individuals and the church to advise and guide us. And yet, there's so many things that he doesn't give us a clear, thus saith the Lord, you shall take this job, or you shall marry this person, or you shall move to this community. Those things aren't clearly stated for us. He allows us to make those decisions. And he uses some tools to help maybe give us some direction, but we are still responsible for those decisions. I mentioned quite a number of tools that the potter uses in addition to the wheel. God uses quite a few different tools to shape us as well. First of all, we think about the personality, the abilities, the strengths, and the weaknesses that are we could say baked into our genes. Think about David talking about God knowing him and forming him in the womb. A lot of the things in our very DNA determine our personalities and the physical aspects of our lives. And so that is one thing that God uses to shape us before we're ever born. And then think about the family and the environment that we were born into. The homes we grew up into, we probably had very little, if any, choice about that. And God used that to shape us. And then circumstances outside our control. And that's something that frustrates people. And 2020 is maybe a prime example of that. Who can control COVID? Absolutely no one. And so there are circumstances that are entirely out of our control. It seems like they knock us one way or the other, and we're just kind of like a cork bobbing up in the sea. Absolutely nothing we can do about that. God shapes us by the people that he brings into our lives. Thinking of teachers and maybe employers or coworkers or friends, those God uses to shape us. God uses the past choices that we have made in an effort to shape us. The good choices that we have made, they set a foundation for making more good choices. But then we've all made bad choices, bad decisions, foolish decisions. God can also use those. And that is when we learn the lessons that come from making bad decisions and choose to not repeat them, but to follow the direction that he would have us to follow in avoiding them the next time around. The choices that other people make help to shape us, and those include the bad choices. Think about the impact that Pharaoh had on the children of Israel. First of all, there was the one Pharaoh who was jealous and fearful about Israel's growing strength and commanded babies to be thrown into the river, and of course that directed the beginnings of Moses. And then the other Pharaoh that Moses spoke to, the plagues and everything that went along with that and how that affected Israel and especially their desire to get out of Egypt and for God to lead them. Then the seventh tool I'd like for us to specifically think about this morning, and that is the influence and the call of the church. And thinking especially with the decisions that are going to be made in the next couple of weeks, is the call of church the same as the call of God? And I believe it is. Because God has delegated authority to the church. He's made that clear in numerous places in the New Testament. And when the church as a body prays, when it seeks God's direction, and when it calls someone to an ordained office, it is exercising that authority that God has invested in it. And this call must be made with all the wisdom that the congregation unitedly can put together. The wisdom that God has seen fit to give us, both the leaders who are responsible in leading out in the ordination and the members as they contribute their part in the ordination. The call to ordination is not given lightly, considering the approval of the congregation for an ordination. It's not given lightly, considering the prayers and the soul-searching that has already taken place. It's not given lightly, considering the effort that is being made to follow biblical instructions for ordination, including looking at the qualifications for leaders that Paul wrote about in several places, Timothy and Titus especially. This call is not given lightly, considering that the effort is made to find scripturally qualified candidates. And this call is not given lightly, especially considering the lifelong changes that it makes to the brother who is called, to his companion, and to his family. That call should not be received lightly either. And I understand you just had reorganization here, and you'll be changing Sunday school classes, there will be new teachers and so on. There are a lot of other calls that are made by the church or by committees or organizations affiliated with the church. There's mission boards, there's school boards, there are Sunday school superintendents, there's the voting maybe on different offices. I'm not entirely familiar with how your church handles it, but there's that voting on offices. There's calls that are made, And those calls are good. They should not be, if you get asked to serve somewhere, you should consider it carefully. But those calls do not have the same weight that an ordination does. For one thing, maybe you're 20 years old and you're kind of interested in teaching school, and you get calls from four different school boards around the country asking if you would come and teach. Now, are those all the calls of God? Well, obviously not, because you can't teach in four places at once. When you come and think about ordination, though, there's a major difference between that call and these other calls I've been talking about. And that difference is maybe symbolized by the laying of hands that takes place at the ordination. That is a weighty call, and therefore it's different because of its life-changing effects, both on the leader who is called and the effects it has on the congregation. Now, though, when we think about the call of God through the church, there may be questions that you are struggling with. I know these are questions I've struggled with in the past, and others in our congregation have. And I'd like to think about four of them, and we won't address them, the answers specifically necessarily, but maybe some guidelines to help us find those answers. First of all, supposing I place a vote or a nomination for a candidate, and that candidate is not chosen to be the new minister. And maybe we would consider this even worse, supposing the candidate that I voted for is not even in the lot. What's wrong with me? What's the problem here? Supposing that I am in the lot and I am not chosen, was there something wrong with me that God did not call me to that responsibility? And then maybe the most the most weighty question is, supposing I am in the lot and I am chosen, how can I be comfortable that this is God's call for me? Thinking especially of the first couple questions, the candidate I vote for is not chosen, or he is, or maybe he's not even in the lot, is there something wrong with me? Let's look at some concepts in Ephesians chapter 4 that may help us find some peace in that. Paul speaks in various places about the parts of the body working together. Notice what he says toward the beginning of Ephesians chapter 4, verses 4 to 6. He says, "There is one body and one spirit, even as ye are called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all." And you read those verses and you think there's one body working together here. There's one local congregation here. So why can't we have the unity that God does and everyone come up with the same name? So there's absolutely no question whom God has called. Well, Paul's not done there. Look at verse 7. He says, "But unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ." Notice that word measure. And then going down to verse 11, he says, "And he gave some apostles, and some prophets, and some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ." Now, you look at that verse, it sounds like one person, one body, one united one. And yet you look back at verse 11 and he lists multiple offices that are in that body. Then notice the outcome in verse 14, "that we henceforth be no more children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. But speaking the truth in love, may grow up into him in all things, which is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplieth, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, maketh increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love." If we were to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul speaks more about the parts of the body, but he's not talking about apostles and prophets and teachers there. He's talking about ears and eyes and noses and hands and feet. And do you think that my nose has the exact same opinion as my ear does? my nose is concerned about different things than my ear is, assuming that they could think independently, which obviously they can't. But we are made of different parts, and some of you might represent a nose, some of you might represent feet, some of you might represent hands. Well, considering the different roles that these play, God is not anticipating that the thoughts of these different parts would be exactly the same, because they see different needs and they meet different needs. And I believe that we have to operate on the understanding that God has deliberately given each of us only a measure. That measure that's spoken of in verse 7, we only have a measure of the gifts and the wisdom of Christ. In fact, I would like to look in Romans chapter 12, verse 3, that word measure is used again. He says, "For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith." Now we ask God to increase our faith, and yet this verse seems to suggest that God measures it out to us. And I don't know if the exact meaning of faith is the same here or not, but it's very clear that God gives me something, he gives you something, he gives you something else, and he measures it out in what he feels is appropriate to the responsibilities that he has given to us. And so I do not believe that God intends us to vote alike. If we did vote alike, we would be missing something. God has brought us from different backgrounds. We come from different families. We have different viewpoints. We have different thinking patterns. And that is not a mistake on the part of God. Those different parts, those different viewpoints are necessary. We're not cookie cutter products. We're not even nearly as similar as this lamp is to a bunch of other lamps the potter may have made at the same time. We're more different than that. God has made us individuals. He loves us as individuals, and he expects us as individuals to contribute our part for the good of the body. Now, I don't want to be guilty of beating a dead horse, but let me just come back around to this again. I strongly believe that God deliberately withholds information from us as individuals. Information, insight, wisdom, whatever you want to call it, God does not give us all that in order to force us to work together. And it's when we come together, when we are honest with ourselves, when we are honest with those who are taking our vote, and those things weigh together, and then God can make something that is much greater than the sum of our individual parts. And so if you find yourself in that circumstance, think about the fact that God has very likely given you a name, if you were honest with him, if you spent time in prayer, even though he may have known that this person is not the one that is called, simply to recognize your need to rely on the judgment of the group as a whole. We don't have all the answers. In fact, we don't even know all the questions. Now, a temptation that can come after an ordination or in other circumstances, I have to think about what happened to Job and all the things that he went through, the things that he struggled with. And we may be tempted to start second-guessing God and demanding answers from him. Now, the fact that Job questioned God, I don't think that was a problem. But toward the end of Job's thinking and talking, there's a little bit of arrogance there, I think, almost as if, God, you owe me answers for what's going on here. And then God speaks to him out of the whirlwind and reminds him of all the many things that Job has no understanding about, that God perfectly controlled, and Job suddenly realized where his position was in relation to God's. And so we don't know all the answers. Some of them may become clearer over time, but I think there are some questions that will never be answered on this side of eternity. We simply don't know why God chose to do what he did and why he called who he did, but that's not for us to take upon ourselves. It's for us to be able to trust him in the end. And when we deal with things like that, both before an ordination with all the unknowns and afterward when things are at least somewhat more clearly known, we have to choose whether we are going to be moldable clay in God's hands. This thing here had no idea how it was going to turn out. This thing here did not resist Mark's hands as he shaped it and as he painted it with glaze and as he fired it. It didn't demand that he stop the heat at 900 degrees because it couldn't handle anymore. It let him go ahead with it. And obviously this thing loads far less than what we do, simply because it's inanimate material. It's not the way God has made us. We have a lot of advantages over physical clay. We know the potter, and he has made clear to us the care with which he has assembled us, both physically and our soul and our spirit. We know the planning that the potter has made in, and also the sacrifice that he has made for his church. We know his promise that all things will work together for them who love him. And the group of people who love him, it's made clear that though that group of people is the ones who are the called according to his purpose. And we know that even the fire that he puts us through, that we think we absolutely cannot handle, that it's more than we can bear, that fire is for the purpose of making us strong and fit for his use. And another thing we know is that failure does not thwart his plans, that he will continue to work on us, he will reshape us if we're willing. Now, when Jeremiah was watching this potter, something went wrong with his clay. I'm sure he didn't have the formulation that potters do today, and I don't know if there's a rock in it or maybe a hard spot or something. Anyhow, he had to take that thing, he had to crush it down. I'm assuming he probably had an impurity or something to remove, and then he started all over again with us. And our potter's knowledge and skills exceed that of any earthly potter. When we stumble and fall, our potter is there to help to reshape us, to mold us again. And that may be painful, thinking about, the weight of those tools working on us and the remolding that takes place. And he will continue to work on us as long as we allow him and let him have his way with us. And as long as we're willing to let him to continue to touch our lives and our hearts, he'll continue working with us. Now, this thing basically had one chance. Once it hit the fire the first time, got up to 900 degrees, there was no turning back. Well, God gives us many, many chances as we go through life. And when we fail, he will continue to work with us as long as we are willing to allow him to do that. And then one more lesson I think is important to know, and that is that the potter controls the destiny of the clay. Turn to Romans chapter 9. When Mark made this thing and he set it on the shelf, he could have looked at it and said, I don't really like the looks of that, and he'd just fling it, just get rid of it. The potter controls the destiny of the clay, but notice what is said here in Romans chapter 9, verses 20 and 21. He says, "Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, Why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay, of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor?" And clay may be something, pottery may be something that doesn't interest you that much. After watching Mark working on his wheel, I found it quite fascinating, especially as knowledgeable and as friendly as he was in describing the process. And to me, this is a vessel to honor. It looks nice, it shows design. There's obviously been some work put into it, and it's something that I enjoy. I like looking at it, and I think it's something that was worth the potter's effort. And the challenge to me as an individual, to you as individuals, and also to this congregation, is that God is the one who makes us what he wants us to be if we allow him. And my prayer for us, again, for me as an individual, for you as individuals, thinking about what the call might be and where God is going to place you, is that God would make you a vessel to honor, not something that gets discarded because it's a flop, but something that has allowed him to work, something that is willing to submit to the fire, and to all the discomfort that goes with that, and placing no limitations on him, telling God, use the tools that you have, use the glaze, use the fire, and make me what you want me to be. Make us as a congregation what you want us to be. And recognizing that when that happens, God is honored through what he can do in our lives. So again, may God bless you. Thank you for your attentiveness, and especially as you look toward choosing a leader in a couple of weeks, we pray that he might continue to work that process in your lives.